threatened to topple her as she gazed at the bewildering maze of rail lines and roadways. She turned her attention ahead and saw five massive roofed structures. They were not buildings as such, for they had no walls, and beneath each of them stretched eight straight tracks that continued underneath the walkway she was on. The sound of rotors and engines had faded with distance, but as they descended, it was replaced by a background noise of a different kind. Shouts, moans, and cries. A disturbed muttering rippled through the Adaba companies as they encountered its source. Beneath the bridge, on a platform many kilometres long, tens of thousands of conscripts were being herded towards the open-topped carts of a train that stretched out of view. Goad-sticks crackled, and the bellows of provosts with voxmeters cut through the audible misery of the massed people. The anarchy sickened Zenobi, as much as the obvious suffering of those unfortunates being loaded for transport to their zone of deployment. It was such a stark contrast to the orderly manner of the Adaba Defence Corps.
"I wonder where they're from,"
she said to Celine, the woman between her and the retaining wall to their left.
"I don't know, Yeye, but they don't look happy to be here."
"Ketumi wastes," said Member. "Look at their tattoos."
He was right. Amongst the press of bodies, it was possible to see the distinctive white facial tattoos of the nomads that lived in the Ketum-rad deserts.
"Hee-hee, grit-eaters,"
laughed a trooper just in front of Zenobi. She recognized him from Gamma Platoon, but did not know his name.
"Don will hurt his back bending to scrape so low for his armies."
"They fight Alaskan just the same as you or I, Ketai," snapped Member. "And their blood will water the ground all the same, too. You think the war cares what station we each come from?"
"I'm just glad we're not sharing space with them, is all I'm saying, Yeye. Don't be taking hurt for their feelings. They don't have none."
"That would be us, if it were not for the course," said Zenobi,
fingers tightening around the haft of the standard over her shoulder.
"Swept together and thrown into wagons like animals. Only because we work together are we marching like this. So you keep your mean words in your heart, and not let them come to your lips."
"She is right,"
called out someone outside Zenobi's eyeline.
"We have bonds. We are all family. But when we fight, we'll be doing it for all Terrans, yeah? All humanity. For Adaba.
For Adaba,"
came the reflex cry in response, even from the mouth of Ketai. He fell silent but shook his head as he continued to glance down at the awful scene playing out below. The stink and sobs of the indentured troopers growing stronger as the rampway took the Defence Corps down to ground level. Chapter 5. A monumental task. The assault begins. The locomotive. Lionsgate Spaceport, Eastern Approach, 6 hours before assault.
"Remind you of anywhere?"
Forex said to his companions.
"Cadmean Citadel,"
Kroger grunted the name of the place where Perturabo had elevated him to the Trident. To Forex, it seemed that journey had now been completed by Kroger's appointment to general command of the assault on the Lionsgate spaceport, but Kroger made no mention of it.
"As though drawn on a far larger canvas,"
said Falk.
"Far, far larger," agreed Forex.
Cadmean Citadel had also been a spaceport, a mountain of a tower raised and defended by the Sons of Dawn. Forex recalled it as something of an arduous campaign, among many such labours of war in which he had taken part. Yet it seemed a mere anthill in comparison to the structure that rose out of the Imperial Palace, dwarfing even the mountains from which most of the Emperor's grand city had been hewn. He was a considerable distance away, and yet had to crane his neck to see its summit, lost against the haze of the upper atmosphere, now fogged by bombardment debris and energy discharge. It was a ziggurat, in rough outline at least, half as broad at its base as it was high, large enough to be considered a hive city in its own right. One of the largest, in fact, though its purpose was not residential, but logistical. From this angle, he could just about make out the highest connecting transitways between the spaceport and the Imperial Palace. Highways and monorails and viaducts, each half a kilometre across, big enough to carry the bulk transport of the immense cargoes that pass to and from the ships docking at its summit. Cadmean Citadel had been large enough for traders and carriers to land, but the very largest, vessels like the Arx Mechanicum and the Legio Titanicus transports that had sworn for the War Master, could not enter so far into a gravity well, nor withstand re-entry to any significant degree. They were giants born in the void, and destined to die in the void. But the Lion's Gate spaceport was so tall that such considerations were no longer valid. Starships were not forced to shuttle down their loads in smaller landers, but could disgorge the contents of their kilometres-long bodies directly to the massive elevators and carriages.
"Do you think we brought enough guns?" said Forex, turning his attention to the infamous siege train of the 4th Legion.
The landing had begun 3 days ago, while Mortarion and Angron had occupied the attention of the defenders. Still, the dark blur of shuttling craft could be seen, linking the distant drop field with a succession of starships in orbit. The column of armoured vehicles stretched all the way back to that landing site, nearly 40 kilometres of undulating metal serpent intent upon the Lion's Gate. Like the Trident and the 25,000 legionaries that accompanied them, the wall-breaker companies of the Iron Warriors had been landed within range of only the largest defence cannons of the spaceport, and they were directed upwards to fend off any direct approach from orbit. Lead formations had encountered little resistance, the bulk of Dawn's forces having been withdrawn to the final defences within a few kilometres of the spaceport. A mountaintop had been flattened by orbital scouring to create a level a kilometre across, tiny compared to the vast expanse of the Katabatic Plains that had been flattened for the Imperial Palace, but enough to allow heavier landers to bring down squadrons of tanks and assault guns.
2,308 Basilisk assault guns, said Kroger,
reeling off the list as though pleased with the feat of memory. To Forex, it was the least requirement of command to have the complete logistics of one's force ready for immediate recall.
1,522 Manticore assault rocket carriers, 13 modified Sakaran bombards, 476 Deathstrike platforms, 495 Medusa howitzers, 1,306 siege dreadnoughts, 84 Typhon siege guns, 7,118 Thunderburst toad guns.
Forex allowed Kroger's voice to become a drone as he continued to list the tens of thousands of support tanks, land raiders, and other armoured beasts committed to the attack. It was nearly 80% of the Legion's armoured might in the solar system, the rest being kept in orbit or the outer reaches, or already deployed in support of the efforts being made by the other Legions and Primarchs, particularly Mortarion's attempts to break the wall to the western side of the palace. Their efforts would be rendered obsolete if the Iron Warriors could break through at the Lion's Gate. To the north and south stretched the support echelons, Imperial Army forces sworn to the War Master and appointed to Perturabo, as well as various vassal hosts that had come under the sway of the Iron Warriors. 1.5 million men and women, as well as countless beasts, mutants, and freaks of the warp. Forex didn't care much for such grist in the war mill, but viewed them more as a lubricant. Their blood would make the machine of battle turn more smoothly for the warriors of Perturabo. For perhaps the first time in decades, Forex felt that the 4th Legion would be given credit for its victories. He thought back to when he had left Terra, just a line legionary, embarking on the great crusade for the Emperor. He had harboured no illusions regarding the glory of war. The brutal truth of battle had been revealed to him during unification, but they had all felt something of a greater promise to the war they would unleash. Reclaiming Terra and Luna had been a stepping stone. The Great Crusade was the endeavour for which history would laud the Space Marines.
"I left from here, you know,"
he said to his companions. Kroger grunted, annoyed at the interruption to his logistical liturgy. Falk turned a helmed head, cocked slightly to the right.
"Really?" said the warsmith. "I knew you were from Terra. I did not realise you were native to the Himalaya."
"I wasn't," Forex corrected him.
But before the 4th Legion were dispatched, we were granted honours by the Emperor. The parade to receive his salute. We went straight from there on to our first crusade campaign.
He looked again at the sky-piercing stalagmite of ferrocrete and plasteel.
It was smaller then, of course.
Watching the seething mass of humanity and inhumanity spilling like a stain across the catabatic plains, Forex realized that the non-Legion elements of the army were driving straight towards the spaceport. By the early morning, they would be in range of the spaceport's main batteries and the heavy weapons of the trench lines around it.
"You're launching the attack without any preparatory bombardment," he said, unable to hide his incredulity from Kroger.
"Perturabo was quite clear in his orders,"
the other Triarch replied.
"Speed. It was your plan, wasn't it? Take the port city before dawn can respond. There's no point wasting shells on a city where the defenders are hiding behind the walls. The scum will bring them to their gun positions, and then the heavy metal will fly."
Forex bit back any reply. He could think of half a dozen flaws in this approach, but remembered the injunction of his Primarch not to interfere. It was this brutish simplicity that Perturabo desired.
"I recall Cadmean Citadel again," said Falk. "The Lord of Iron's coming went very poorly for some. It would be wise not to draw the Primarch's personal intervention, especially as he has been most specific in his desire not to become embroiled in Dawn's trap."
Forex was not convinced that there was any trap, but he was not about to argue the matter with Falk, whom he had once considered a close ally, but now viewed with deep suspicion. The Warsmith would not hesitate in reporting any perceived misdemeanours to the Primarch. There was the added benefit that when Kroger's lack of expertise led to failure, he would pay the price of the Primarch's wrath. His replacement might be more amenable to Forex's desires, or at the least, more wary of ignoring him. Jibu Transition Station, Afrik, 106 days before assault. Under the shade of the station, Zenobi felt the chill, her bare arms sheened in sweat from the morning sun and the long walk. It was not just the sudden drop in temperature that set her skin prickling. As they passed into the shadows, she saw the gun towers. They were built into the great pylons that held up the roof, dozens of them stretching along the narrow platforms between the tracks. Her fingers sought the arm of Menba next to her, gripping it tight just below the elbow. He glanced at her and saw where her gaze was directed.
"You've seen guns before,"
he said with a shrug, his lasgun almost falling off his shoulder. He hiked it back into place.
"Look where they're pointed, cousin."
Quad-barreled heavy stubbers tracked back and forth between the scores of companies filing into the station. On walkways between the pillars, visored guards patrolled, heavy carbines at the ready.
"They're not here to protect this station against attack."
"It doesn't mean anything," insisted Member.
He cocked his head back towards the loading platforms, where the waster conscripts were still being corralled into their wagons.
"Maybe there was some trouble before." "Why would they suspect us?"
"They don't. It's like the dynastic security teams. They don't expect any trouble. It's just for show."
Their pace had slowed to a few meters a minute as the companies pushed together on the raised rockcrete. There was nowhere to go. No way of avoiding a lethal fusillade if the guards decided to open fire. Her heart pounded harder and faster as she imagined the muzzle flare and screams. She remembered the stories Auntie Hermela had told her of the old food riots, how the corridors would be filled with bodies, the stairwells red cascades of blood.
"I can't even lift my arms," Zenobi muttered, "much less fire my lasgun. What are they afraid of?"
"Nothing," growled Member. "It's procedure. It's not for us."
"Why would it be for us?"
In the press of bodies, the banner pole was pushed tight against Zenobi's chest. She ran a hand along it, seeking reassurance from the touch.
"Dawn put out the call, and we answered."
Nemba leaned towards her, face earnest, voice quiet.
"There is nothing to worry about."
Zenobi tried to look around to take her mind off the matter. But there was little to see. She was one of the shortest in the company, and even on tiptoe she could barely see past the shoulders of her companions. It was not long before the ground started to vibrate. It was almost undetectable at first, but quickly grew in vigour. Through the soles of her boots, Zenobia could feel it thrumming, a slow, pulsing sensation.
"I think the trains are coming," she said, as excited muttering and whispers spread through the assembled platoons. "It's nearly time."
She saw Ketai was right in front of her. He was rangy for a factory hiver, almost 1.75 meters tall. She heard Ketai gasp, and there were other expressions of surprise and shock rippling through the troopers. Zenobia tugged at Katai's collar.
"What is it? What is it?"
She thrust a hand at Member, and then Ketai.
"Let me see. Help me up."
The two glanced at each other, and then sighed, turning towards one another and crouching so that their knees formed steps. It was common practice in the work crews to help reach a fouled gear or belt, and more illicit destinations among the factory levels, such as the crawl spaces used for a quick mozo smoke break, or to share a flask of Thai. Zenobia's lack of height meant she was used to such improvised ladders, and she quickly scaled the two men, coming to rest on their shoulders. From her elevated position, she could see across the mass of troopers to the far end of the station, several hundred meters away. In the sunlight, beyond the shadow of the vast roof, something dark was approaching along the tracks, though it was hard to tell what it was amongst the dust kicked up from the old seabed. At first, she thought it was 8 trains approaching in unison, for the dark patch within the dust cloud straddled all of the lines that came into the station. Another half-minute revealed the error of her assumption. It was not multiple trains, but one vast engine running along the parallel tracks, which meant that it had to be more than 100 meters wide. She glanced up at the roof, understanding now why the station required such titanic proportions, to accommodate a vehicle that was easily 30 meters high. Her upbringing in the confines of Adaba had not given her much of a sense of distance, and the train's massive size made a mockery of normal perspective. So it was only after watching for several minutes that Zenobia realized it was still some way off, at least 0.5 kilometer. It was approaching slowly, probably no faster than walking pace, its slate-grey armoured prow forcing its way through the bank of grit and sand kicked up by its passage. The rails between the platforms were humming now, their vibrations coursing into the rockcrete with increasing volume. A hushed sense of awe settled on the Adaba troopers as they watched the marvel of engineering bearing down upon them like the great elephants of old Earth myth that could lay waste to armies with their curving tusks and fearsome bellows. The hum became a rattle, while from the distant train came a grumbling of metal wheels, accompanied by a higher-pitched whine. Zenobia could make out more of its prow as it neared the far end of the station. There was an offset cab at the upper left side, probably large enough to house a crew of dozens, but seemingly small against the flat angle of the train's impossibly broad nose. On the other side was a multi-gunned turret, one of several that blistered around the engine car, each holding 2 large-bore cannons and a variety of small anti-personnel armaments, much like those of the gun nests beneath the station roof. A fog billowed from exhaust vents along the sides, tinged by pale blue light from within the immense locomotive.
"Plasma reactor," whispered Ketai.
Though it was still slowing, moving at barely a crawl as it passed into the gloom, massive air displacement sent a sandstorm roiling along the rails and platforms. Warning shouts greeted the cloud of swirling dust as troopers covered their faces and turned their backs in a ripple that passed back through the crowd.
"Watch yourself!"
Member cried out, pulling Zenobia down from her perch, one bulky arm crooked around her shoulder to pull her into the protection of his chest. She scrunched her eyes shut, the rattle of grit and sand and the curses of the Adaba hivers heralding the arrival of the dust cloud. It scoured across the back of her neck and prickled at her exposed shoulders, swirling between her and Member, who had his chin buried in his chest, a calloused hand like a visor on his brow. The light disappeared as the dust wave passed over them, but the gloom was nothing compared to the darkness beneath the train as it snarled over their heads, the clatter of wheels like the deafening pound of 100 forge hammers, the wheeze of venting coolant vapour, long shriek of braking plates and tremor of throbbing power lines churned in Zenobi's gut. She gripped the front of Member's coverall with her free hand, fingers making a tight fist in the material, as the monstrous engine continued to rumble over them, the absence of light combining with the noise to overwhelm her senses. Only another minute or two passed, but it felt like an age until quiet suddenly descended. It was broken by the coughs and muttering of her companions, and the slow tick, tick, tick of cooling metal. Bright orange lumens flared into life along the length of the train, bathing the platforms with harsh light. Zenobi blinked tears away, teeth gritted against this fresh assault. As her eyes adjusted, she saw that the underside of the train was barely 2 meters above her head. Slender metal ladders rattled down from hatches to either side of the platforms, the interior of the train lit by a more ambient yellow gleam.
"Boarding begins now!"
The command rolled along the station from the front, passed from officer to sub-officer to squad leaders.
"Ascend to the third level! Stow your kit beneath the cots! Sit on your cots and await further instructions!"
Again and again, these orders rang through the companies as the troopers recovered and started to move towards the ladders.
"This way! This way!"
called Lieutenant Okoye, pushing his way towards a ladder on Zenobi's left, the sealed underside of the train blazoned with a numeral beside it, 143.
"First squad, climb the ladder and take the stairwell to the top. Move it."
The platoon shuffled forward as one, directed by their common destination. Zenobi waited until she had space to manoeuvre the banner into the opening, pushing it up the ladder towards Sergeant Alexander, who waited at the top. Her lasgun swung down between her legs as she climbed, threatening to trip her, until she wrestled it back onto her shoulder. Shouts from below urged her to hurry, and she almost lost her footing, swinging by one hand, just a toe on a rung.
"Here! Here, your hand!"
Someone reached down and she grabbed the proffered wrist, feeling iron-strong fingers curling around her own. She was almost bodily lifted into the opening and deposited on the decking. Zenobi looked up to see who had helped her, and saw that it was Xerxes, the sergeant from 3rd Squad. He was short like most hivers, but so broad she wondered how he had fitted through the hatch.
"Come on, Yeye! Up you go!"
he said, pointing to a metal spiral stair a few meters along the narrow passageway. Zenobi took a couple of steps, and then returned to claim the banner from Alexander. Her sergeant raised an eyebrow.
"Keep it safe, Zenobi."
Face flushing with humiliation, not just regarding the banner, but her whole undignified entry into the train, she hurried to the stairwell and ascended, not daring to look at anyone else until she had reached the top level. The stair brought her out into a chamber that ran half the width of the train, filled with cots. There were no windows, but every few meters a ladder pierced the ceiling.
"Not that way!"
called Kitai, as she took a step away from the stairwell. He waved her closer and pointed to the bunks that lined the metal wall.
"First squad over there!"
She nodded her thanks and hurried over, joining the increasing throng of troopers spreading out into their strange accommodation. The cots were plain metal frames with thin mattresses, built atop a low locker box. She realized that each bunk had a serial etched into a small brass plate on the headboard, and swiftly decoded it as company, platoon, and squad, followed by two initials. She found hers quickly enough, just as Member and the others arrived, Alexander bringing up the rear.
"Welcome to your new home, brave troopers of Adaba,"
the sergeant announced, tossing his bag onto the bunk next to Zenobi's.
"Next stop, Himalaya."
"Oh, Throneheart, we come into you,"
said Celine, her grin flashing uneven teeth yellowed from too much mozo. She winked at Zenobi.
"Hope you packed clean baggage, Yeye. We off to see the Emperor."
Chapter 6. The First Wave. Allies in Blood. Integrity Officers. Lion Primus Strategium, Sky City, 6 hours before assault.
Dross,
Fafnir ran, handed the data tablet back to Hagar.
A lot of dross, Commander.
Hagar passed the report to one of the Logisteria attendants, who withdrew to his post. The strategium was designated Lion Primus, and Ran had set it up in the 298th level of Sky City, replacing the civilian command hub that had once run the Core Ward's transport network. Vox murmur and the clicking of auger relays provided a constant backdrop to the conversation.
300,000 strong and growing by the hour.
It doesn't matter if there are a million of them, Lieutenant Commander. Logistics and physics are on our side. A force that size can't bring all of its strength to bear against a narrow front.
We cannot allow them to reach the defence lines, argued Hagar.
We can and we will. But I'm not throwing valuable soldiers away to hold a line in the dirt. All forces will withdraw to the Lionsgate spaceport.
An adjutant in the uniform of the Terran Conscriptia hurried across the strategium, her brow furrowed.
Withdraw, Lord Commander.
Drop the Lord. I'm not a Primarch,
Ran told the young woman. He saw confusion in her eyes, shared by Hagar.
Perturabo is like a Vox broadcast on repeat. This tactic of sending in the worthless masses has been tried over and over since the traitors landed.
And Lord Dorn has seen fit to match them with our...
Hagar glanced at the adjutant, unsure of how to phrase his words.
Basic mass formation troops,
the adjutant replied quietly.
That is the correct term in the Imperial Army.
Indeed,
Hagar continued.
The enemy would have us expend our strength slaying mutants and beasts. Our orders from Lord Dorn are simple, to hold for as long as possible.
I'll not have brave women and men slaughtered just to save some bolter rounds,
Ran growled. Hagar looked as though he might object further, but Ran silenced him with a raised hand.
It's not sentimentality. We have to take the initiative now and then. Otherwise Perturabo and his generals will think they can do as they please. I want them to feel uncomfortable.
Am I to send the withdrawal now, Lord... Commander Ran?
How long until all the outer defence regiments can be inside the port?
2 hours,
the adjutant replied promptly.
3, if you want us to set demolitions beforehand.
I'll do that,
Ran said with a smile.
The first enemy wave will be here in 6 hours. Do not begin the withdrawal for another 2. I want our enemies to commit to a plan before we change things.
The grand batteries of the Iron Warriors will be within range,
said Hagar.
If you wait that long, the withdrawal will be made under fire.
We'll boost the base layer fields, extend them a kilometre for the final hour of withdrawal. Redirect power from the mess effects to compensate for the drain on the reactors. Leave enough for the upper defence cannons to dissuade any orbital approach, but drop the shielding. If Perturabo wants to capture the spaceport, he's not going to start by bombarding the landing docks.
The adjutant waited for a few seconds to see if any more commands were forthcoming, and then snapped off a sharp salute before moving to the closest communication station. Hagar remained.
You're not happy, Lieutenant Commander.
I would not dispute your orders, replied Hagar stiffly. However, Lord Dorn has been exact in his preparations, both in the raising of the defences and their manning. Is it really wise to discard that on a whim?
A whim?
Ran kept his temper in check, though his fingers tapped on the haft of the axe at his left hip.
Is that how this seems to you?
Hagar was intelligent and chose not to answer. Ran gestured for Hagar to come closer. The lieutenant commander took a step, and being a few centimetres taller, dipped his head slightly. Ran's voice was barely a whisper.
I have commanded the first assault cadre for many years. I bear the title Lord Seneschal, though I don't insist others use it often.
Ran leaned closer still, teeth gritted.
Most importantly, Lord Dorn put me in charge.
He stepped back, voice rising a little, but not enough to carry further than Hagar.
I know you will follow my orders, Lieutenant Commander. I am not going to make a habit of explaining myself. But this time, just this once, because I need you to trust me, I will make something clear.
Ran strode across the strategium, towards the main display, a square table 5 meters across that was currently showing an orbital view of the spaceport and the surrounding 20 square kilometers. It was a simulacrum, generated from records and auger data. There were no Loyalist orbital assets left in the vicinity. A servitor burbled into life at their approach. A torso, head and arms, wired into the side of the table. A nest of cables springing from its spine to other cogitating engines arranged around the chamber. The Logisteria hurried over from his alcove and took his place at a control panel next to the servitor.
"Top view, Highway 4,
said Ran, leaning forward with fists on the plasteel edge of the screen table.
"Analyzing. Compressing."
The servitor's head tilted left and right as it processed the information from the Strategium's databanks. The Logistaria's fingers tapped a few commands into his panel.
"Display adjustment in progress."
The table went slate grey for several seconds, and then flickered into life, showing a rendition of the broad road that led almost straight from the Iron Warrior's landing site to the spaceport, entering by means of a 300-meter-wide barbican and gate.
"Highlight in place defences."
"Highlighting static weapon positions."
The servitor's eyes rolled towards Ran, and then back to the display. Red smudges blurred the walls and towers that flanked the road.
"It's a killing ground," Ran said to Hager.
"Yes, Lord Seneschal. I oversaw the construction."
"Of course,"
said Ran, allowing the gentle rebuke.
"High-powered laser batteries, macro cannons, and assorted plasma platforms."
"A combination of anti-vehicle and anti-legionary guns. The mass waves employed by the enemy will have no chance."
"But the whole point of their assault is to sap our resources. If we sit in the trenches and behind the walls, we'll be doing exactly what Perturabo wants us to do. There's a better way to hold off the attack and ensure we have the weaponry available to meet the full-scale legionary and armoured assault which is bound to follow."
Ran moved around to the Logisteria's position and took up a light wand, with which he started to make marks upon the display. As he did so, he explained his plan.
"I will lead the first assault cadre to meet the enemy attack, supported on the wings here by two columns of heavy tanks and a mobile attack reserve, bikes and speeders."
Ran drew in the lines, forming a V-shape against the line of the enemy advance, with a few swipes to indicate the counter-attack movements from a pair of lesser gateways that flanked the main barbican.
"What will that achieve that the gun emplacements cannot?" asked Hager. "Or the Imperial Army remaining in their bunkers and trenches?"
"It's about planning for defeat," said Ran. "Rearranging the layers so that they work for us, not the enemy. We save ammunition on the big guns until the armoured assault, and keep the volcano cannons and other high-energy weapons dormant, so that maximum power flows to the shields. It's all about time, and how much of it we make Perturabo use up. We can't stop the enemy getting in, not forever. Cannons on walls are no good then, but 30,000 massed infantry holding the interior will be."
"And the assault cadre is as good as any wall," said Hager, nodding to himself.
"A wall we can put where we like," added Ran. "I can assure you that whatever else our enemies have in mind, they have not considered the possibility that our first act in defence will be an attack."
"I shall issue orders to gather the flanking forces in reserve. I assume you will lead the muster of the first assault cadre personally?"
"You assume correctly, Lieutenant Commander."
Ran caught the warrior's eye just before he turned to leave.
"I hope I have made myself clear."
"The doubts were mine to own, not yours, Lord Seneschal," said Hager, banging a fist to his plastron. "I have prepared for this moment for 7 years, but in the event have fallen victim to predictable orthodoxy."
"I can't take all the credit," said Ran. "Lord Sigismund put the thought in my mind. I recall what the Khan and his White Scars accomplished when set free. To be honest, I think the Imperial Fists can do even better."
"We will, Lord Seneschal. Death to the traitors!"
"Death to the traitors," growled Ran. "Every last one of them."
He returned his attention to the display as Hager strode away. The lines and shapes he had drawn looked so simple on the schematic, but he saw them with the eye of a battlefield commander, as ranks of warriors and squadrons of engines, lit by the fury of fire and resounding with the crash of war. It was a bold move, and he was certain of success. Even so, Dawn had not taught him to be rash. He started to think about the many ways the tide of conflict might turn against him, and what could be done to ensure they did not come to pass. 12th Legion Vanguard, proximity of Daylight Wall, 4 hours before assault. The tracks of a solitary rhino transport carved furrows through mud made slick with blood, scattering shards of half-buried bones. Beneath the gore spatter, it was a solid gunmetal, its hatches and cupolas painted in yellow and black stripes. A banner pole bent beneath a broad standard, depicting the metallic skull face of the 4th Legion, blazoned against crossed lightning bolts on a field of black. Battle honours were stitched into dozens of scrolls around the main device, and the top edge showed signs of wear, charred by some historic conflagration that the Iron Warriors had seen fit to commemorate by leaving this scar unrepaired. It passed between broken tank hulls and shattered fortifications, wending a zigzag route through the devastation left in the wake of successive attacks. Even now, magazines and arsenals still burned, pouring thick black smoke into air choked with fumes and toxins. A cordon of large troop carriers in the bastardized colours of the World Eaters marked the boundary of their zone of operation. But there was no challenge or hail levelled at the incoming vehicle. Its passage went wholly unremarked. Within the crude encampment, Legion slaves hauled at great tarpaulins piled with bodies, forging between sagging marquees and makeshift flakboard bunkers. A great pile of corpses was being assembled within sight of the main wall, where 100 weary axe-wielders laboured to behead those that had fallen to Angron's sons. Their blades rose and fell with the monotony of a factory line, turning the dead into righteous sacrifices, though without the least pomp or ritual. Half-human ghouls, creatures suckled on mutant blood and Khorne's power, stripped flesh from bone and polished the skulls, in turn passing them to box-laden beasts of burden, driven by more slaves to the immense mountain being erected in the blood god's honour. These dreary tasks were left to menials, for there was none among the world-eaters that desired aught but to face the enemy and add to the body count of the war. It was industrialized sacrifice, at odds with the highly personal battle-lust of Khorne's chosen, who favoured only the slaying in their god's name. And at this bloody task, a greater part of the Legion still laboured. There was little semblance of chapter and company command remaining, and even individual squads had started to break apart as champions rose from the ranks to create fiefdoms of authority within the fragmenting Legion. Angron cared nothing for this fracturing, for in his presence all were cowed to his will, and cohesion of a sort could be maintained. He was, for the present, absent the battle line, seeking his bloodthirsty pleasures elsewhere around the overrun defences, butchering whatever he came upon. There were a handful of others that could command similar obedience, but they were not of any single mind, no more than the greatest of the warlords that were starting to hold sway where once all was dictated by the Principia Bellicosa. Of these, the most admired was Khan, whose lists of titles seemed to grow daily as his feats of death-dealing continued. The Axe of Khorne, the Death-Gifted, the Walking Ruin, and more. He watched the approach of the rhino from close to a pyre of blackened bones, which he had lit as a beacon for the transport to find him at the appointed hour. Of all the warriors of the 12th, he retained a modicum of strategic interest in the war, and had agreed to the parley on behalf of his Primarch. Now that his battle brothers were intent upon the last survivors outside the wall, it was safe for an outsider to enter, though he knew there was a substantial risk that his own self-control might slip, potentially bringing the world-eaters and iron warriors into conflict with each other. The rhino stopped a short distance away, and a solitary figure disembarked. His armour was reinforced terminator plate, with heavily riveted banded strips like the oldest marks, a brutal throwback to the earliest days of the legions. His oversized left fist gleamed with a power generator, a similarly blunt weapon, and Khan felt himself drawn to the other warrior's simplicity.
I expect you to meet with your Primarch, Angron of the Red Blade,
the Iron Warrior declared, as he stopped a few meters away. Khan snorted hard, clearing the blood fugue from his thoughts to focus on the burly Iron Warrior's commander. He wanted to bury Gorechild into the mask of the Warsmith's helm, just to see the spray of blood. He plucked the man's name from the whirl of gore-choked daydreams that swelled up from the implants in his brain. Kroger, commander of the Fourth's attack on the spaceport.
The Primarch fights where he chooses. I am not his master. He bends to the will only of the Blood God.
So it doesn't matter that I am here for Perturabo.
No, Kroger, it does not.
Khan pointed his blood-flecked axe towards the companies of the World Eaters, storming the last of the outer defences between him and the eastern stretch of the Eternity Wall.
Angron demands that we breach the palace.
The Warsmith stood silent for a few seconds, shoulders hunched.
Fulgrim has already agreed to bring his legion to the attack,
Kroger said, his attempt at guile obvious.
Would Angron be outdone by his brother?
You are fortunate. Fortunate that my lord is not here to respond to such taunts.
Khan gritted his teeth, biting back the urge to cleave the Iron Warrior's head from the torso as payment for his petty remark.
I don't need Angron,
snarled the Warsmith, fists rising.
I need your legionaries. You'll all die before you set foot on the Eternity Wall. But I have a plan that will get you into the Lionsgate spaceport.
You'll need more inducement than that.
Dawn Sons.
The man's savage grin was audible in his tone.
Never mind mopping up the scum of the Imperial Army. Don't you want to cut down the brothers that betrayed us?
I understand where the betrayal lies.
Khan stalked back and forth, wanting to end the conversation to join the assault. The crack of bolters and battle cries of his companions called to him, the urging of his implants like a hot barb dragging him to the wall.
The World Eaters I knew would never seek the easy battle. Perhaps I don't need you after all.
Kroger turned away, and Khan was about to let him go. Another force, the whisper voice that ran through his blood, sounded louder than the insistent bark of his nails.
Wait, Kroger!
Khan could sense the metal of this soldier, and heard the thunder of corn in the Iron Warrior's hearts. This was one who could be kin to the World Eaters. The Blood God was willing to lay his hand upon Kroger, and that demanded special attention.
Angron might listen. A call to arms from one dedicated to the Skull Throne might catch the Primarch's ear.
What do you mean?
Kroger stepped back, his fist rising. It took every effort of the 12th Legion captain not to react to the implied threat. The hand clasping the haft of Gorechild almost moved of its own accord.
You have the qualities of a great warrior,
said Khan.
The sort of warrior Khorne would bless with his blood gifts. He demands nothing but what you want to give already. The deaths of your foes.
The Emperor has already made me stronger than any mortal man,
said Kroger.
What other gifts do I need?
A wreck of a rhino transport protruded from the blood-slicked earth a few meters away. Khan turned to it, the teeth of Gorechild spinning faster until the weapon howled in his grip. The champion of Khorne took two long strides and launched himself into the air, leaping higher than any normal space marine was able, axe in both hands. He brought the weapon sweeping down as he landed next to the wreck, its shining teeth slashing through armored hull and track housing with a single mighty blow. Shattered ceramite and scattered track links exploded around him.
Khorne's power flowed through him, energizing, setting his mind aflame through his butcher's nails, so that the growl of his axe was a soothing purr. Khan balled a fist and drove it into the flank of the armored transport. His gauntlet split under the impact, but his bone did not, punching through the armored plate to the elbow. He tore the panel away with a wordless shout, hurling it far out across the blasted wasteland.
"Nothing stands before the chosen of the Blood God and lives!"
he roared, turning on Kroger.
"No blade will pierce my skin! No bolts can scar my flesh! Swear yourself to Khorne, and you will become his bloodied killer. Every life you take shall be offered up to his glory, and every moment you will know the joy of slaying. All I need to do is kill in his name."
Kroger laughed, long and deep.
"No oaths, no rituals, no sacrifices."
Khan staggered towards the Iron Warrior, letting Gorechild fall to his side, ignoring the smell of his own blood flowing from the ruin of his hand.
"As long as the blood flows, Khorne cares not for words."
Kroger lifted his combi bolter, shining in the flash of artillery and the continued flare of orbital lance strikes.
"Then let Lord Angron know that a brother in blood calls on him to carry his holy slaughter to the Lion's Gate spaceport, and we shall please the Blood Gods together."
Jibu Transition Station, Afrik. 106 days before assault. The scale of the train defied belief. Zenobi and others investigated their new surroundings while the rest of the regiment boarded. Even the idea that a single vehicle could transport the 10,000-strong 64th Defence Corps seemed insanity. On trying to ascend the ladders, they were rebuffed by armed provosts and told that the upper deck was for the crew only. These menacing sentinels bore red sashes over their uniforms, marking them out as dynastic chosen, the direct servants of the factory dynasty overlords of the Hive. Zenobi didn't know when they had arrived. They certainly hadn't travelled with the worker platoons, over which they now stood watch. A few scouts that dared glances past these impassive-faced guards reported weapon storage and doorways that the gathered troopers deduced were for access to the gun turrets that lined the roof. There was speculation as to what else might be found, and within half an hour the upper level had attained a semi-mythical status as a realm of plenty and comfort. Conversations with wanderers from the decks below confirmed that each level was identical and windowless, save for the bottom deck, which was home to huge cabling links that connected the immense carriages together. There were basic cooking facilities at one end of each carriage, but no mess area. They would be expected to eat at their cots, it seemed. At the opposite end were the ablution blocks, which seemed woefully inadequate for the number of people that would be using them. The prospect of extra latrine duties rapidly became one of the worst punishments the sergeants and officers could threaten. 2 hours after boarding, the train still hadn't moved. Zenobi broke open a slender ration bar she had smuggled into her kit bag and sat down on Member's cot to share it with her cousin.
"Everything else is all about move, move, move. What's taking so long?"
Zenobi asked, but received only a silent shrug in reply as Member chewed his portion of the ration bar.
"They must have everybody on board by now. What's the delay?"
"You're eager.
You're eager,"
said Switana, from where she lay with her hands behind her head, two bunks over.
"This isn't so bad. I think this bed is bigger than the one I had back at Adaba."
It was odd to realize the truth of what she said. Zenobi had never realized how cramped life had been in the Hive factories, but comparing it to the space on the train...
A train?
It was clear that, all things considered, there was more comfort in this mobile barracks than in the worker dorms of their home. A sudden stir amongst those quartered near the foremost stairwell drew attention from across the barracks deck. Zenobi stood on the cot to see what was happening.
Just as she gained her elevated position, she caught a glimpse of swirling crimson and purple, as a knot of officers gathered with equal suddenness in the vicinity of the new arrivals.
"Dynastic colours,"
Zenobi told those around her, her voice hushed with respect.
"Maybe the Rubyborn are coming with us."
"Don't be such a fella, Obi,"
said Member, pulling at her arm to dismount the bunk. She snatched herself away from his grip, so she could carry on watching.
"They're staying at Adaba to oversee the defences and keep things running."
The scattered discussions were silenced by barks from sergeants and platoon officers, and a few moments later the officers parted to reveal half a dozen newcomers, three men and three women, whose blue officer uniforms were additionally adorned with silken sashes of red and mauve, as Zenobi had seen. They were all shaven-headed and clean-cheeked, and bore the lean, muscular build of Uphiver enforcement. Red ink marked their eyelids and lips, giving them a stark, otherworldly look.
"I guess that was who we were waiting for," said Member.
Captain Egwu stepped forward, eyes scanning back and forth across the assembled company.
"These are our company integrity officers, sent on behalf of the dynastic chiefs to ensure their reputation and intent is maintained by the defense corps assembled in their names."
One of the integrity officers joined the captain, a woman with a sharp nose and cheeks, her forehead adorned with an additional red diamond tattoo.
"I am Jawa here, Adonai Hadinet, integrity high officer for your company.
Some of you may know me by the name my inmates gave me as punitive overseer of the East Main Spur Correctional Complex.
The Iron Warden."
The name meant nothing to Zenobi, but judging by the scattered muttering from across the company, the announcement meant something to others. It was certainly a title that bode poorly for any transgressor.
"We are not here to uphold Imperial Army regulations. We will not be judging the quality of your kit, nor monitoring your training drill. We will deal with disciplinary infractions that reduce the fighting effectiveness and discipline of this company. We will ensure that you adhere to a deeper truth of loyalty and dedication to the cause."
This was met with silence. The assembled troopers were experienced enough in the work line to keep their lips sealed when a superior made such an announcement. Right from the outset, the integrity officers would be watching for any with a loose tongue or showing signs of insubordination. Zenobi suddenly felt quite exposed, standing on the bed of her cousin, but dared not climb down in case the movement drew further attention.
"There will be one integrity officer for each platoon," said Captain Egwu. "They will make themselves known."
She stopped as the train trembled. The growl of reactors being brought to full power could be heard through the walls. The floor trembled as motors were engaged. There was barely any feeling of movement, just the slightest tug of inertia giving way to acceleration.
"They will make themselves known to each of you in time,"
Egwu continued, raising her voice as the throb of the locomotive continued to grow. It was joined by the first metallic clatter of the wheels, muted by the thick hull of the carriage. She glanced at Jawahir.
"You will defer to the commands of the integrity officers at all times. Their word is law, their judgment absolute. I advise you now not to test their patience or resolve, but to comply with their wishes without hesitation or dispute."
The integrity high officer cleared her throat, and Egwu retreated a step, ceding even her authority to Jawahir.
"The entire corps will be subjected to introductory interview in the coming days, to get to know each of you better."
"Thank you,"
began Egwu, but she was cut off by a glance from the high officer. The look was passive enough, no scowl or other visual admonishment in her expression, but it silenced the captain immediately.
"I want you to bear no illusions, troopers of Adaba,"
Jawahir told them, folding her arms. A movement in the crowd between Zenobi and the integrity officer briefly afforded her a full view. A long maul hung at one hip, and a pistol was holstered at the other.
"There are those that are looking to turn us from our purpose, seeking weakness in our hearts. The enemy will stop at nothing to strangle all liberty and resistance, and their agents are moving amongst you even now."
Zenobi glanced around, expecting these spies to somehow reveal themselves immediately upon being accused. There were others darting suspicious glances at their companions, and she started to ask herself just how well she knew the people in the other platoons and companies. She caught a look of annoyance on the face of Member, and she threw him an inquiring gaze. He subtly shook his head, motioning with his eyes towards the integrity officers.
"This is a war. We will win with courage, determination, and sacrifice,"
Jawahir continued.
"Your resolve will be tested. Your stamina will be pushed beyond anything you have ever endured. Your loyalty to the cause will be called into question time and again. Against all of these threats, physical and mental, you must stand strong. We will be here to remind you of your duties and oaths."
Her hand dropped to the pistol at her hip. Whether unconsciously or not, Zenobi could not tell, but the message was clear.
"Company!"
snapped Egwu, bringing them all to attention. She paused for several long seconds, her gaze passing over every trooper under her command.
"Lunch rations will be issued in 30 minutes. Your platoon officers will detail those on catering duty. The rest of you will attend to maintenance. The forces of Horus are not far away, and soon the battle for Terra will begin. You will be ready when called upon."
With a flick of her head, she dismissed them, then turned to her officers, pointedly ignoring the integrity officers, who moved as a group towards the nearest ladder leading up to the roof level. A collective sigh escaped the mustered troopers when the last of them had disappeared through the hatch, and Zenobi dropped down on the bunk, a nervous laugh escaping from her as she landed. She heard her name being called by Okoye as he made his way across the carriage, along with others being summoned to the kitchen.
"We've nothing to worry about,"
said Member, gripping her hand as he dragged her off the cot.
"Whatever these interviews are about, just tell the truth. Remember that you are of the Adideji, and our ancestors were kings."
She gave him a half-smile and a pat on the arm before she moved to join the others assembling around the lieutenant. She gave a last glance back to the banner pole that she had stowed between her cot and the wall. It was her badge of pride, her talisman of loyalty. Surely she didn't have anything to worry about from integrity officers. Chapter 7 Big Guns Never Tire. Serration. News from the Void. Katabatic Plains. Assault Hour. A lifetime of war had inured Forex to the pound of heavy guns as much as it had the beating of his own hearts. Yet there was something majestic about the power unleashed onto the Imperial Palace by the War Master. The sky itself was blackened, a roiling storm of discharge and plasma, through which burning mass driver rounds crashed like meteors and beams of lance-light strafed. Perturabo had unlocked the secrets of the Aegis that had warded the walls, exposing them to direct bombardment and assault. But the Sanctum Imperialis and surrounds were still swathed by energy screens. So too was the Lionsgate spaceport. The air about it shimmered with barely contained energies. Great guns about the circumference of the spaceport prevented warships from lying too in orbit directly above for fear of counter-bombardment. The risk of a broken starship crashing upon the landing docks they were trying to capture was too great a risk, which had been pointed out to Kroger when he had sent requests to their Primarch for orbital support. Smaller weapon arrays, still dwarfing those carried by anything smaller than a Titan, ringed the port in bastion outcrops. They roared now, spitting defiance down into the packed regiments of turncoat Imperial Army and devolved creatures. Anti-air batteries awaited their turn to bark rebuke, for Kroger had not yet committed his aerial assets to the attack. If Thorax had assessed the situation on what he could see, without knowledge of what was to come, he would have laughed off the assault as a piecemeal, uncoordinated affair with no chance of success. It would have been a mistake. Kroger was a straightforward warrior, raised in the best and worst traditions of Iron Warrior's stubbornness and dogma. He lacked finesse, or even any desire for finesse, but that did not make him an idiot. He had explained his plan at length to Forex and Falk, ensuring they understood their parts well enough, as well as his overall objectives. There was nothing to do but enact Kroger's will, or risk the ire of Perturabo, and so Forex had accepted his allotted role without question. There was every chance that his directness was just the hammer needed to break open the Lock of Dawn, as Perturabo believed. Advancing with bolter in hand, a tide of soldiery and beasts around him, Forex's auto-senses picked up the first distinctive cracks of the siege train, loosing its wrath. A dozen kilometres behind him, battery after battery of cannons coughed forth a cloud of shells. The muzzle flare of their anger lit the skies, silhouetting their deadly rounds. A rolling thunder of noise followed, a shockwave that swept over the advancing legionaries and auxiliaries, bending banner poles, fluttering topknots on crusader helms, and washing over the unarmoured masses with a hot wind that brought cries of astonishment and dismay. They howled as eardrums split and sinuses burst. Those foolish enough to look upon the moment of firing left reeling as a flare brighter than the sun burned out their sight. The noise of the weapons loosing was as nothing to the detonation of the defensive shields. The bombardment could not reach the highest sections, but was targeted at the middle layers, so that the spaceport seemed girdled by a ring of fire 5 kilometres high, arcs of power forking 10 kilometres to the ground below. The release of so much energy created a counterblast that flowed down the uneven flanks of the port like an avalanche, gathering roiling vapour and debris as it descended to smash into the first companies of auxiliaries daring the lesser guns at the base. Bodies by the hundred were picked up and dragged through the crushing cloud of shell shrapnel and fire, cutting a swathe through those that followed. It was the single most powerful explosion Forex had ever witnessed, and was yet the overture for the fusillade that was to follow. As the last after-shimmer of the void shields dissipated, the cannons spoke again, this time accompanied by the hiss of 50,000 rockets and 20,000 missiles. This fresh wave of brutality smashed into the labouring shields just half a minute after the first. Purple and blue coruscated through the air a few hundred metres from the armoured skin of the spaceport. Explosions racked its surface, hurling chunks of plate and showering burning rubble down its mountainous slopes. Not from impacts, but void shield generators that had torn themselves apart under the strain of resisting the gigatons of rage unleashed upon them. And again, the great guns of the Iron Warriors fired. Lionsgate Spaceport, surface approach, Highway 4, 1 hour before assault. It was almost impossible to think, much less hear, under the force of the bombardment. The ground shook constantly, while dirt rattled down from the rafters of the gun pit. Trooper Elijah Goldberg cupped a hand to his ear to listen to what Sergeant Kasny was shouting to the squad. He was standing at the Vox hardline from the headquarters fortification, and had been silently nodding for the last 60 seconds.
"It's our time!"
The sergeant hung up the Vox receiver and gestured towards the 2 support guns mounted in the firing slits.
"There's no tractor! We'll pull the last cannons ourselves!"
"This is ridiculous!"
Goldberg shook his head and pointed to the intermittent flashing of shell bursts outside. He cupped his hands so that he could be heard.
"They want us to give up a nice, safe bunker and go out in this? Well, you can stay here and wait for 500,000 mutants, traitors and beastmen if you want,"
the sergeant replied. Goldberg considered his options and sighed and pushed himself to his feet.
"Do we have to take them?"
asked Trooper Kawa.
"They'll slow us down and the spaceport has got plenty of big guns."
"We take them,"
Kasny said decisively.
"I don't want to be shot by my own guns tomorrow."
The squad busied themselves making the las cannons ready for moving, locking them onto the metal trails, securing the energy cells and detaching the braking pins so that the rubberized wheels touched the floor. They'd started with 3, but a third of their small battery had been taken out by a rogue piece of shrapnel through the firing slit 3 weeks earlier, along with Trooper Sabag. Goldberg and Costa lifted the trails of the closest las cannon and hauled it towards the ramp out of the gun pit. Closer to the opening, the bombardment was even more shocking. Blast waves washed hot wind over his face, and he blinked against the fire and detonations.
"Where are we going?"
he yelled to the sergeant.
Kasny waved her hand directly through the doorway.
"Just head for the spaceport and keep going!"
The sergeant looked around as the second las cannon trundled up behind him, Kawa and Adon at the lifting bar. He pulled out a las pistol, though Goldberg had no idea what it would be used for.
"Everybody ready?"
They all nodded and set their backs to the task, a slow pull becoming a steady walk as they mounted the crest of the ramp. Goldberg glanced up to see the heavens dancing with blue and orange fire, coruscating over the screen of the void shields. Despite the energy fields, stray rockets and shells fell to the ground, cratering the broad ferrocrete strip of the highway and its muddied surrounds, tearing bloody holes into the tide of soldiery pouring back to the sanctuary of the Lionsgate spaceport. The heavy weapons squad picked up pace as they hit the flatter surface of the road, joining thousands more Imperial Army troopers. Alongside, half-tracks and flatbed trucks bobbed and swayed as they picked their way over the shell-rucked earth, carrying the wounded and those that deemed themselves too important to walk. Above one mud-spattered transport, Goldberg saw the huge banner of Colonel Maygrout, bright scarlet and edged with gold braiding. It seemed incongruously colourful among the mud and drab uniforms. Everyone looked as tired as Goldberg felt. Some trudged with a half-vacant look he had come to know well, uniforms of grey and green splashed with blood, their own or others, and dirty from the long siege. Faces smeared with grime, bandaged, arms in slings or showing other wounds, they became a river of humanity flowing together along Highway 4. Goldberg barely flinched when a shell detonated a few hundred metres to his right, turning an armoured carrier into a flaming wreck that pitched down a slope away from the roadway. His back burned with effort as they broke into a slow jog, feeling the crowd around them moving faster. Nobody was counting exactly, but everyone knew that the enemy would be at the defence line in minutes, if not there already. At any moment, lasfire and bullets might start chasing them up the highway, far deadlier than the rage of the artillery being expended on the void shields above. A deeper, longer rumble sent a tremor along the road. Some troopers cried out, living their waking nightmares. Others called warnings and broke into a run, ignoring the shouts of sergeants and officers.
"That's not a bomb," said Goldberg, looking back.
The others stopped with him and turned. In the distance, a couple of kilometres back, a wall of fire spread behind the line of retreat, following the arc of the last defence line. More detonations stretched the flames further and further. Every trench, gun pit, bunker and foxhole turned into an inferno. Adon laughed and patted the barrel of the las cannon.
"We'll be waiting for the survivors."
Goldberg spat in the dirt.
"Burn, traitor scum!"
he shouted.
"You can all burn!"
Lionsgate Spaceport, surface approach, Highway 4, assault tower. Traitor corpses were piled so high they formed a bloody rampart in front of the Imperial Fist's shield wall. The enemy continued to press on regardless, scrambling over their own dead to be picked off by heavy weapons and marksmen as they crested the ridge of cadavers about 20 meters ahead of Ran, silhouetted against the fires that continued to rage along the former Imperial Army positions. A line of yellow-armoured warriors stretched almost from one promontory of the outer defence to the next, half a kilometre wide, a solid bank of power armour and boarding shields, as inflexible as a plascrete rampart. The line was unmoving, a last obstacle to be overcome should any foe survive the storm of fire that roared over their heads from support squads and dreadnoughts, as well as the bastions of the spaceport itself. Here and there a mutant creature or turncoat army trooper staggered almost impossibly through the cannonade, only to meet the solid wall of Imperial Fists. The smallest partition allowed a bolter to fire with deadly accuracy, taking off the traitor's head or ripping apart their chest with a single bolt. The line would close again, as though nothing had happened. Ran watched through the visor of his shield for any threat, as alert 2 hours into the battle as he had been the moment he had led the counterattack from the armoured bastion. So far, the Iron Warriors continued to direct their fire against the spaceport, mostly ignoring the force of Space Marines that had sallied forth. The shorter-ranged artillery that supported the attack had so far been kept at bay by the extended defence screen. Ran glanced up to see an aurora of gold and green above, rippling beneath the impacts of rockets and airbursts. Should any enemy gunner feel like encroaching within the dome of the fields, a whole flank of las cannons and multi-launchers were poised to greet them with counter-battery fire. Similar precautions had been prepared for aerial attack. Even so, Ran expected to hear the telltale whistle of a descending shell, ready to abort the armoured attack and withdraw his force the instant the murderous barrage of the 4th Legion started to fall upon his warriors.
"Commander, this is Verdas on the left flank,"
his vox crackled, the message from one of the dreadnoughts assigned to support the first assault carder.
"Lines of fire are getting very narrow. The dead are blocking our sight beyond 30 meters. Suggest an advance to establish a new base of fire."
The phrasing was so respectful it made Rand smile, coming as it did from a Terran veteran of the chapter who had served longer than he had.
"Understood, Verdas. I'll give you more room."
Ran switched the vox channel to contact Lion Primus.
"Status report on armoured attack.
Preliminary bombardment underway. Gates opening now, Commander. Estimate contact with the enemy in 3 minutes.
Inform the Lieutenant Commander that I'm moving forward our battle zone by 50 metres.
Affirmative. Recalculating safe zone for air and artillery strikes, Commander.
A mutant Ogryn shouldered its way through a narrowed part of the carcass mound. It was clad in pieces of angular armour, a bladed helm strapped across its misshapen head. In its hands it carried a length of metal topped with a lump of ferrocrete, a broken lumen pole from the highway partition. Bolts exploded off its makeshift warplate, and those that found flesh did not hinder its advance in the least. 5 more seconds and it would be on the line. The risk of even a single breach was unacceptable, and Ran responded instantly.
"By threes, target front, converging fire,"
he told his huskarls, fingers slipping into the trigger guard of his bolter.
"Single round, fire!"
Every third warrior hinged his shield to the left, allowing the space marine on their right to fire through the gap. 50 bolters, Rans included, barked as one, engulfing the monstrous aberration in a storm of detonations. Shards of metal and hunks of flesh flew from the welter of bolts, leaving a ragged mess to flop to the floor, the lumen pole crashing down beside it. As swiftly as the line opened, it closed again, shields crashing back into place alongside each other. Ran didn't believe in the concept of overkill. Whatever it took to ensure the target went down, he considered proportionate. Even 50 bolt rounds for a solitary Ogryn. He checked the chronometer. 90 seconds until the armour columns hit. That too might be considered more force than necessary, but he was determined to send a message to the Iron Warriors that Dawn's sons were not at this battle just to take punishment. The 4th Legion would be following on the heels of their expendable horde, and the last reports had detected both Fulgrim's and Angron's warriors moving in support of this offensive. It was nearly time to withdraw to counter the approaching traitor legionaries coming at the Lion's Gate from the north and south. Ran forced himself to wait a further 30 seconds, ensuring they drew in as many of the traitor scum as possible for the armoured attack.
"Carder to attend!"
he voxed his entire command, hearts beating faster in anticipation of action.
"Huskarls, prepare for serration and advance. Echelon squads to give support fire."
He took a deep breath, holding himself for just another 2 thunderous heartbeats.
3, 2, 1. Serrate!
Starting with the warriors either side of Ran, every other Imperial fist in the front line lifted his shield and advanced 5 strides. 2 warriors from the rear ranks followed on the heel of each, one firing left, the other to the right, sweeping the ground before them with a welter of bolt rounds. No sooner had the first serration planted their shields than the remaining frontline legionaries lifted theirs and advanced 10 paces, each also joined by 2 support warriors. Ran advanced with them, measuring his stride, and then drove his shield down into the filth of mud and gore that soaked the ground. Again and again the line advanced, pushing with fusillade and shields into the charging enemy.
The huskarls, like a saw, cutting into the heart of the attack, while any foes that tried to circle behind them were mown down by fire from the flank squads and supporting dreadnoughts. 20 meters at a time, through 10 times their own number, they pushed onwards.
Echelon squads advance! Hourglass attack! Huskarls, link for breach!
Flank squads withdrew behind the shield walls to allow the enemy to flow to the left and right of the line. Ran judged the moment, waiting 20 seconds, then gave the command for the advance by spear point. Like a wedge through dirt, the Imperial fists forced their way onwards, using their shields as a bulldozer's blade, pivoting outwards to trap the flanking foes against the spur walls, treading over the slain as they did so. The support squads held the centre with rapid bolter volleys and heavy weapons, until the line hinged together again. Dead eyes stared at Ran from the ridge of bolt-cratered bodies and broken bones. Ran felt a swell of pride at the discipline of the manoeuvre. It had been simple enough to sketch it on the tactical display, but the precision of his lieutenants and sergeants was a thing of beauty to him. He wished Lord Dawn had been present to appreciate it. With the full line advanced as far as it could, the huskarls clamped their bolters and took up their close combat weapons, chainswords, for the most part, a few with axes like Ran. As they had with the Serration manoeuvre, they alternated hewing at the dead and living alike, while their companions pushed forward with their shields, pressing into the mounds of tattered flesh. Ran heaved, angling his shield slightly so he could chop at limbs and bodies as though cutting through tree branches across a jungle track. Pieces of corpses were trodden into the muck as he moved forward. Push, step, hack, push, step, hack, push, step, hack. The dead were